I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Between the debates, a glance away from the horse race. It's the country and the riled up people that have made 2016 such a shock. More compelling maybe than the candidates. And still to be explained, the rancor in a recovering job market, the huge generational split, social grievances, old and acute, a raucous new tone out there, and an aura of decline. Place to place, the varieties of American experience stick out. This hour, the feel of three scenes we don't hear much about: the Louisiana oil patch, the rust belt of southwestern Michigan, and the aftermath of a steel town in Ohio near the border of Kentucky. The extended Confederacy, some call it. Sarah Palin's Real America. J.D. Vance has written a number one bestseller, Hillbilly Elegy, about his own hill people who aren't doing very well, he says. Bonnie Jo Campbell writes stories about a longing in Kalamazoo to be useful, to be needed again. Arlie Russell Hochschild gets us started. She's an esteemed sociologist who went to find the enclave farthest in political spirit from her own deep blue Berkeley, California, and then spent 4 years immersed in deep red Lake Charles, Louisiana.
I wanted to take my alarm system off and really try and open myself to listen, to cross what I came to call an empathy wall. And that was the journey. That took me 5 years. I interviewed 60 people, 40 of them Tea Party, and hung out with them, went fishing with them. I asked them, you know, could I see the school you went to? Where were you born? Could we visit the cemetery where your parents are buried? And went to fish fries. I met some very interesting, complex, unusual, and admirable people. And this is a book that tells their story.
Arlie, sketches, if you would, individuals, you know, and you heard the coin dropping, something connecting.
When I first got there, I went to many meetings of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana in Lake Charles, which is a petrochemical center of the country. And across the luncheon table, I met a woman who said, oh, I love Rush Limbaugh. And with my alarm system off, I said, I really love to talk to you and get to understand that. So the next day, we were meeting for sweet teas, and she began to explain that she loved him because he hated feminazis. And she explained that that's what she thought were women were cold and ambitious and cruel and self-centered, and that's what that meant for her. In the course of telling me that, I don't know what my face looked like, but she said, was this hard for you to hear what I'm saying? Which I thought was a very dear question for her to ask. I said, actually, no, it's not, because I'm suspending my beliefs. The purpose of being here is to really come to empathize and understand you and your experiences and this situation that has led to those experiences. And she said, you know, I do that too. In other words, I can take my alarm system off and I can listen too. And then she began to explain why she really loved Rush Limbaugh, which was that she felt he was protecting her from a lot of the epithets that get hurled by coastal liberals. You know, you're just a southern, backward, uneducated redneck who must be racist, who must be homophobic, who must be sexist, and a little fat. So in a way, she described Rush Limbaugh, this right-wing radio commentator, as defending her, as her brave heart. Well, I learned a whole lot about her feelings.
What was her name?
It's Madonna Massey, and she's a fantastic gospel singer in a Pentecostal church, and her husband is the minister in that church. And on a Thursday at 7 in the evening, they hold the service a little late so that the guys in the plants can comb their hair, get in their trucks, and come and join the service.
So when the epithets get stripped away, and we're just talking people now, how does she see herself?
She sees herself as a lover of private enterprise, as someone who wants a much smaller government, as a proud member of the Tea Party. And she's defending a way of life that she feels is valuable, but dishonored. She feels dishonored. She fits what I came to call the deep story, which I think underlies the right-wing perspective. And what a deep story is life as it feels. You take the moral judgments out, you take the facts out. It's a story of life as it feels. And in this deep story, she's on a pilgrimage. She's in a line waiting with a lot of other people that's going uphill, the top of which is the American dream. And she feels she has worked extremely hard for this dream. And the line is not moving. And then she notices people beginning to cut in line. That would be affirmative action blacks who were gaining access to jobs formerly reserved for whites. It would be affirmative action women gaining access to jobs formerly reserved for men. It would be immigrants. It would be refugees. It would be public sector workers. And then, in the deep story, she sees Barack Hussein Obama waving to the line cutters. Then she feels, oh, he's their president. He's helping them. He's sponsoring them. In fact, is he a line cutter too? I often heard people say, how did the son of a single mother who was, you know, struggling along manage to pay for a Columbia education, a Harvard education? This must be rigged. He must be one of them. And I'm increasingly a religious person in a secularizing society. I'm a white person. There are fewer whites in America. That in many ways, I'm marginalized. And then the economy is at a standstill. And I am a stranger in my own land looking for rescue. That's her deep story.
It's very compelling the way you put it together. But just for the fun of it, I mean, what's my deep story? What's your deep story? What's the coastal deep story by contrast?
The coastal deep story, again, with moral judgments out and facts out, we're all ranged around a very large public square. And we're not actually holding hands because if somebody comes up next to us, we make room for them. We're incorporative. And in the middle of this public square is a fantastic, state-of-the-art children's museum available free for all. And there are fantastic public schools and libraries and museums available to all. And we are fiercely proud of what's in this public square. We built it as public sector workers or nonprofit people or private enterprise people, but with this value. And then we see some people, some marauders, come into our public square and pickaxe out chunks of concrete from that state-of-the-art children's science museum and take it out and start building a McMansion, a private place behind our back, and then come and do it again and again. So we're upset that our public sphere is being derided and reduced, and our source of pride is hurt. So that, I think, is our deep story.
Is there a chain of causes, a hierarchy of fears that drive this mindset?
I would call it a constellation of fears. I think racism is a quick and easy answer, and economic distress, quick and easy answer. These are all elements in a larger loss of identity and a search for rescue. There are people who feel that the government is a giant marginalization machine. They have been pushed back and they distrust whatever the government does. They just feel it has the wrong priorities, that it edges them out. As whites, but also as blue-collar workers, as less educated people, and they feel like a minority group, but they feel like they can't say that. So it's a mixture of things. Let me tell you another story, if I may.
Please.
About
please.
A man who was born on a sugar plantation. His father was the plumber. He was Cajun, fifth of seven children. And he spent his adult life working for companies that helped the oil industry. First thing he said is, well, I'm a Tea Party person, and I think that the government erodes community. And I believe in the beauty of local community. He lives on a bayou. He loves nature. He's a big fisherman. In this bayou, it's called Bayou Corn, a private company was drilling for brine, which is very useful in fracking and for various industrial uses. And it cracked open a underlying salt dome. And pretty soon the water in the bayou started to go down like water in a bathtub. And it pulled down 100-year-old cypress trees, sucked into the sinkhole. And then there were earthquakes never heard of before. And then methane gas started to bubble up. When it was raining, it looked like Alka-Seltzer in the rain puddles. And this man, who loved nature and hated the federal government and the local government and loved private enterprise, was faced with the loss of his community at the hand of a private company. And he's refused to leave. That's how much he loves this Bayou Corn home. Others have left. The streets have no lights at night. There are feral cats moving around. He has a gas monitor in his garage because methane gas is rising in his garage. And if you lit a match, who knew how safe he was? I asked him, why are you here? He paused for a while and said, actually, I don't want to leave.
Coming up, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton make their entrances in Arlie Hochschild's Deep Story of Louisiana, and then Bonnie Jo Campbell's Kalamazoo. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We've heard the candidates in debate. We'll hear them again. What about the country this hour? The Berkeley sociologist of family and the workplace, Arlie Hochschild, left familiar territory 5 years ago to write Strangers in Their Own Land, drawing out the deep story, as she just called it, that animates right-wing America. So what, I asked her, do her subjects in oil and gas Louisiana see when Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton come into view?
I watched the first presidential debate with an eye to what the predisposition of a right-leaning person would be. Through their eyes, how did it seem? I think what stood out for them was any time he showed himself to be an outsider or different from mainstream politics in Washington as usual. So when he said, you know, I'm a businessman and I have a different skill set, they would have loved that. He claimed to be a victim, an underdog. The media is on Hillary Clinton's side. They would have related to that. And curiously, they would have liked what would have turned off a lot of liberals, that he interrupted her and the moderator a great deal, and he hogged more time than she did. And this would have been seen not as boorish and rude, but as a sign of masculine dominance. He had the right to interrupt. I think they would have actually seen that covertly as a plus more than a minus. It appeals to, I think, a subliminal desire for a secular rapture. He talks about how low down and bad shape America is in, that we have poor schools and bad roads and tunnels and hospitals, and America is down on its heels. People would relate, yes, Yes, it is. And I am too. And then he's offering to lift people up. America will be great again. And scooping them up with him. So it's almost like a moment of like religious belief in the rapture, but a secular monetary version of it.
Now, imagine those same people looking at Hillary. Mm. Secretary Clinton, I should say.
Yes. They see in her an agenda of uplifting everyone else but them and pushing them back into a ever more marginal group. It isn't this policy or that so much as what they come to see as the mainstream agenda.
If they thought they could get a hand up, where would it be? Would it be college education for their kids? Would it be jobs? Would it be a cultural shift of some sort?
Yes, it would be all of those. And let's start with cultural shift. They felt very insulted by liberal comedians that they could hear, you know. And they often would say, well, you know, we're being called rednecks. They came from poor circumstances. Many have done well to get out of poverty. But they felt that they were tarred with these epithets and not acknowledged. And so I think part of it was, look, there's a lot of class, social class prejudice going around, and let's get rid of that. And then, yes, college education, but especially for people in junior college and community colleges to train in the trades. Many actually wanted this kind of education for their children and found it was too expensive for them. And also, the companies wouldn't take on even people with trade degrees unless they had experience. Now, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, companies would give workers experience on the job. And they wouldn't say, oh, come to us when you're already experienced. So companies are offering actually less to workers. And even the right-leaning people I talk to realize that. It's not that they love these companies they work for. They've been worked hard by them, but they don't see another source of support.
When you speak of people seeing a marginalization machine that's abandoning white people, blue-collar people, less educated people, a minority unto themselves, that's the target of the Trump campaign. How do you see him reading the situation, playing it?
I spent 4 years getting to know these Tea Party people, and just at the end, I went down to an enormous rally the day before the Louisiana primary, where Trump came flying in his private plane to land at a private airport in New Orleans. And I felt, oh, I've spent all this time studying the kindling, and now I see the match. Yeah.
How did he know?
I think he's brilliant at reading people emotionally. He's not brilliant at leading, you know, a country at all, but he's a charismatic leader. People are looking for someone with policies who speaks in a reasonable way, who knows that words have to be carefully chosen. No, he's not that model. He keeps people off balance all the time. He makes himself unpredictable so that people are always oriented to him and see what, you know, there's a bull in the china shop. What's the bull going to do? Turn left, turn right. Mm. And that's what charismatic leaders do. And they don't have big bureaucratic, well-organized machines. They just trust themselves that they are the source of the word. You know, Moses was like that. And some people take Trump like that. Oh, well, he will know. So he's, in a way, appealing to a need to have faith in a leader that will make them feel like they're not strangers in their own land.
Among so many Louisiana people who vote for Donald Trump, what's the emotion in that vote? What's the look on their face? Is this a joke? Is it hopeful? Is it a protest? Is it a remedy?
There is mourning going on. What we see is anger, but under that, I feel that a lot of people I really came to know were in mourning for a lost industrial sector that gave them union-protected, secure jobs. That world has gone. And, you know, they used to feel kind of culturally embraced and central, and that experience is gone. So there's a feeling of loss. And when Donald Trump purses his lips, at first I thought, when I was on my side of the empathy, well, oh, this is an arrogance and just a, you know, prune expression. But when I got to know them and tried to climb into their shoes, I think they see him when he's silent, you know, and his broad shoulders, and he's standing in some soldierly way, that he is absorbing their mourning. I think they read that on to him. He knows how bad it is. He's speaking for us.
Where did they think he picked it up?
Some think he's descended from heaven. If you've looked at some of the signs, you can Google them. There are signs that say Trump is like God and Jesus. When I was at the primary rally in New Orleans, there was a man who was talking to no one in particular, but saying in an odd voice, to be in the presence of such a man, to be in the presence of such a man. He'd been captured by the charisma. And so people felt that he was taking their mourning somewhere. He wasn't just absorbing it. He was going to bring rescue. And I think what we learn from that is that there are real problems that people have, and they are have made them desperate, and that someone else has, you know, walked on in and is appealing to that desperation. I think we have to separate Trump, the user of that desperation, from the desperation itself. There are conditions that we need to address that would relieve them of this sense of invisibility and also economic fear.
That was Arlie Hochschild distilling her Strangers in Their Own Land. 1,000 miles north and east of Lake Charles, halfway between Chicago and Detroit, Kazoo, Michigan, they call it, the bedding plant capital of the world, is the territory of the story writer Bonnie Jo Campbell, the master of rural America's post-industrial landscape, in a Boston Globe review. I asked her to walk us around.
Well, Kalamazoo is kind of the bigger town I grew up outside of, and most of the characters I write about would be people living maybe 10 to 20 miles from Kalamazoo. And they might have worked in Kalamazoo in the old days. Kalamazoo was a town of, you know, machine shops. They made checker cabs here. A lot of people work for car companies, and there aren't a lot of those jobs left. Most of the jobs are kind of low paying. The people here, you know, kind of expected the world to organically provide them a place in it. I mean, there was a place for us when we all had to be farmers. There was an obvious place for us. And then there was another place for us when we had to be working fat. And I'm mostly saying we, meaning men, ironically, but when we had jobs that were important jobs and that maybe paid well enough to feed our families, we were necessary in the world. And now that these changes have come where people are not born into a world that needs them, rather we're expected to make ourselves into the people who are needed by the world. I think this is a complication that we haven't really negotiated yet. We're wired to want to be essential and needed.
It's a thread in everything you're saying. People want to be useful. They want to be protective of somebody else.
And you might want to be with them if there was an emergency.
I bet.
My people here would get you through some very harrowing situation, or they would feed you off the land. but they might not be as entertaining in some other situation where survival was, you know, less of an important thing.
Hate to be literary about these things, but you're reminding me of the Hemingway fishing stories and also of Flannery O'Connor. Dark places observed minutely.
Hemingway is tapping into an element that does exist in Michigan, this place where a man can be a man and a boy learns to be a man. There is a common element in Midwestern writing, or at least Michigan writing, and Southern writing. Our places are not so different. I mean, a lot of people in Michigan came from the South. They came up when Henry Ford needed workers for his auto plants. And so most of the people in Michigan have a real connection to the South and have had it for a while. That's when I wanted to be a writer, when I read Flannery O'Connor, and I realized how these strange, brutal stories of the countryside really resonated with me in a way that maybe the Bronte sisters did not. And Flannery O'Connor's stories are filled with displaced, disconnected, disaffected men. They're men who are no longer connected to the farms, and they became something different when they no longer were on the farm or were needed on the farm.
Bonnie Jo, a little fiction writing exercise here. I mean, can you imagine the inner monologue of a Trump voter? What's the problem? Where did it arise? I mean,
I could read you passages from actual writing that I have.
Do it, please.
"Please don't die," he whispers to the girl. "When a girl lies on the pavement, when a boy is drowning, everyone should run to help. If the foundry where he worked above vats of molten steel for 16 years has become obsolete, then shouldn't the world outside the foundry be noticeably more advanced? He had intended to work at the foundry forever. His burns were a pact the foundry made with him, but they disassembled and dissected the equipment with torches and sold it as scrap iron in a world unprepared to reshape these materials into advanced medical machinery. He has hurt this girl. He won't deny it, but the whole world is guilty too. Because of the world's refusal to soothe burns and infected teeth, to heal drowned and broken bodies, what point is there in a world like this one, he wonders, where working machinery must be melted down, where the cleverest scientist drowns, where he and this girl must wait in the dirty slush alongside the road and stare into the face of pain? The girl's freckles seem like holes through which her life might pour out. She may already be dissolving. Each of the three dead rabbits in the back of his El Camino, each flea-ridden pelt contains about a pound of meat. After seeing the girl's wounds, he will not be able to skin the rabbits. He knows, too, that they are not enough to bring to his old man, who thinks his son should have more to show for his life. The siren grows louder, and the girl is still alive. He is alive with her. Tears are falling out the sides of the girl's eyes, and he feels grateful. His own tear ducts have been damaged by his not wearing goggles at the foundry."
I hate to go from sublime characters to ridiculous politics, but what's the view of 2016? And if Donald Trump's airplane landed in Kalamazoo, if Hillary walked on stage in the biggest auditorium in Kalamazoo, read the minds of your characters.
I'm thinking about this business of people feeling needed or feeling necessary in a community, and I'm thinking about the different visions for the future. I guess I'm thinking about who my characters or my neighbors, whose vision they are most interested in. You know, Donald Trump is presenting a vision that maybe it looks backwards, or it looks at rebuilding the future in a way that looks a lot like the past. Mm-hmm. And it makes a certain group of people feel that they could be a part of it again, that they could be necessary again, that they could be on top again. And maybe that feels good to people who feel like they've been knocked down a peg. But if Donald Trump is promising them that they're going to be important people again, then I understand why that appeals to them. You know, Hillary's vision is a little more complicated. It has to do with this possibility of a world where you have to be willing to become a different person than maybe you feel like, because the world needs different kinds of people. Maybe the Hillary world requires people to be more flexible and to have different possibilities for the future, whereas that's maybe scary for a lot of people. I don't think it's as scary as all that. If I could just sit down at the bar with some of my characters or some of the people who are comforted by Trump, I feel like we could all have a good conversation and puzzle some of this out, but we're not talking enough.
Bonnie Jo Campbell's story collection, American Salvage, was a National Book Award finalist in 2009. The fragment she read was from The Inventor, a story in that book. Her new one is Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Coming up, south through Ohio to Middletown and the ruins of Steeltown family life with J.D. Vance. This is Open Source. Hillbilly Elegy is J.D. Vance's memoir of a family and culture in crisis, a bestseller and book group classic in 2016. It was part of the wake-up call around addiction, poverty, white men in particular suddenly circling the drain in big numbers. Out of a spectacularly chaotic family, first in West Virginia, then Middletown, Ohio, J.D. Vance is a spectacular exception and a fine writer. He credits a rough, tough grandmother and the Marine Corps for saving his life, out of high school to Iraq, then Ohio State fast track, and Yale Law School on the way to Peter Thiel's investment shop in Silicon Valley. I asked J.D. Vance to remember his high school class and picture the story unfolding today in Middletown, heart of the district long represented in Congress by John Boehner, the Republican House Speaker till last year.
You know, for the folks who stayed in Middletown and aren't doing especially well, my sense is that there's this real apprehension because you know something's not quite right and you can't quite put your finger on it. So you may talk about, you know, the politicians or the big businesses or the banks are doing this or that that make your life harder. But there is this real difficult to define apprehension that exists in these communities because a lot of people really don't know what's going on, right? They may point to a villain, but even there, they'll recognize that that isn't the full explanation, that there are other problems in the community that maybe aren't quite as easy to articulate or quantify, but are still very real. And so, you know, you look around at your community and you know, for example, in the Ohio County that I grew up in, Butler County, that's where Middletown, Ohio is, there were more deaths from drug overdoses last year than there were deaths from natural causes. And so you look at that situation and you just sort of say, my God, what is going on? Why are people addicted to this stuff? Why are people using this stuff? Why are people dying from this stuff? And you hear a lot of times in these communities, you know, that stuff is pure evil. It's just pure evil. And I think that gets to how difficult it is to really articulate what's going on in these communities because you're almost so bothered by it and so unable to really place exactly what it is that's going on that you say it's just evil. That's like the only vocabulary that you have to describe what's going on in some cases is this sort of good versus evil dichotomy.
Mm. The thread throughout your book seems to be that the problem is somehow cultural or moral. People don't want to admit they're lazy, that they're grossly irresponsible. They've forgotten self-reliance if they ever read the essay to begin with. Granted that it's all chicken and egg, what do you do with that sort of insight?
Well, I would say that it's not purely that people are suffering from a moral failure. I think what's going on is that it's really complex. There are a lot of things happening. So on the one hand, the regional economy has been really tough on these areas. It's been tough on the people who live there. But on the other hand, there is definitely a sort of moral or character failure. I describe it primarily as an institutional failure because it's not so much that individual people, I think, are morally deficient. It's sort of that the institutions around them have failed. And so For example, families are not doing quite as well. They're more chaotic. They're more violent. That, of course, makes it hard to study in school. It makes it hard to have your own family. When you grow up, you end up taking the lessons from your own chaotic home and passing them on to your children. So that's one issue. I think that churches used to be a really core part of these communities. People used to go to church at about the same rate as upper-income Americans, but now you see that lower-income Americans aren't going to church nearly as much as upper-income Americans. And so there are a lot of different ways, I think, in which the institutions that exist in these communities aren't necessarily supporting people. They're not enabling them to have successful or good lives. And in the absence of these institutions, I do think that some moral failures have moved in. And so you see, for example, the guy who's working really hard and just can't get a job, can't get ahead, can't get a better wage. But then on the other hand, you also see the guy who has a decent job who ends up losing it or quitting it because he's just not showing up for work on time. He doesn't want to work hard. And it's weird in these communities that you end up faced with both types of people. You see the guy who's trying to get ahead, and you see the guy who isn't. And I think that creates a couple of really weird impulses. And the first is that if you're a kid and you grow up and you see everybody talking about hard work, but then at least some people not actually practicing hard work, it becomes pretty difficult to understand what is hard work, what does the virtue of industriousness actually require of me, because you're not necessarily seeing it on the ground. You're not seeing folks who are working hard, but they're still talking about hard work. So what does that really mean if you're a kid who's trying to understand what your moral expectations are for yourself, what your community expects from you? The other thing I think it does is it creates a certain amount of social disunion, a lack of social cohesion, because as my grandma, who was a classic Blue Dog Democrat, did not oppose the welfare state really in any way, you know, she was angry at the people who didn't work. She was angry at the people who she felt were taking advantage of the system in one way or the other. And she had no problem saying, you know, the people who really need it, the people who really depend on this stuff should have access to it. But at the same time, you know, our neighbor is just doing nothing. She's doing drugs. She's cycling in and out of relationships. And her kids are seeing this and they're exposed to it. And they don't really have anything. You know, they don't have the support of somebody outside the home. They don't have good role models inside the home. And so it just creates this, I think, anger that people feel towards members of their own community, even towards their own neighbors, because they see that some people are not practicing the values that the community as a large entity really shares, or at least talks about a lot.
Trump's holding a rally in Middletown, or Hillary's doing a high school event. Put your friends in the audience. What are they seeing in Trump at the end of this campaign? And what are they seeing in Hillary?
Yeah, well, I think what they see in Trump, and my guess, I bet the polls support this, is that Trump's going to win pretty heavily in Middletown and that the margin isn't going to be very close. What they see in Trump is somebody who is at least recognizing the problems that they see around them. You know, Trump is the first candidate who made the opioid epidemic a real centerpiece of a speech that he gave. He's the first person to say, I love the uneducated voters, I love the coal miners, I love the construction workers. In places like Middletown, people feel so invisible to the political process. They feel like the elites of Washington don't even care about us, and if they deign to care about us at all, it's to look down on us. Trump doesn't do that. If anything else, he at least sees these voters, he sees these people, he respects that they have legitimate concerns, and he really sort of tries to go after them in one way or the other. Now, you know, if you think like I do, and I say this as a conservative guy, you know, I don't think that the way that he's going after them is all that helpful. So, you know, we've talked about the way that our racial dialogue in this country has become a lot more polarized. I blame Donald Trump for a big part of that. So I don't think that he's doing anyone any favors. I think he's making them probably a little bit more mistrustful of their neighbors, but isn't offering much in the way of real solutions. And honestly, people recognize that. You know, if you talk to Trump voters in places like Middletown, it's not unusual for them to say, yeah, you know, he's probably not going to fix everything. I don't like the way that he talks about this or that group or this or that person, but you know, at least he's trying. At least he's trying. And that speaks to how low the bar is in these communities, that that's all you really have to do is try, and these voters are willing to listen to you, and in a lot of cases, willing to vote for you. If I'm, you know, looking at Hillary Clinton through the eyes of some of these voters, my sense is that what they see is somebody who maybe is really smart, maybe very impressive, admirable in her own way, but is fundamentally part of the other side of a social divide that they are on the wrong side of. And so what they see in Hillary Clinton is an elite, someone who's made her career in New York and in D.C. who hasn't spent a whole lot of time around people like them, at least in the past 20 or 30 years, who doesn't really care about them, and who's made a pretty penny off of big banks and political connections. And so I think the real worry with Hillary Clinton for a lot of these folks is that she represents the very worst of the country, that the part of the country that they feel super alienated from.
You say the charm of Trump is that he recognizes them, but to what degree is he a joke? To what degree is he a protest? To what degree is the beginning of some sort of reform?
Yeah, well, it's probably all of the above, but I think it's primarily a degree of joke and a degree of protest. You know, there's an interesting way to think about this, which is that if you feel like the political process as it's currently practiced is never going to produce good outcomes for your life, if you think for the past 20 or 30 years, things just haven't gotten any better, then you're willing to sort of roll the die with somebody, right? And so Trump represents, I think, one, a pretty radical departure from a political system that people despise and feel like it's not just not good for them, but it's actively looking down upon them, if not socially and culturally, but also in a policy sense. So that's one piece of it. But there is definitely an element of protest to what's going on to Donald Trump. He is the proverbial middle finger to every social convention and every person that these people feel alienated from. And he's really cultivated that image, right? I mean, if you think about the debate, obviously, a lot of people felt that Hillary Clinton won, but I think that a lot of Trump supporters watched a person who was treating Hillary Clinton, treating the elites, treating the media with the same contempt that they wish they could treat those people if only they had the platform in which to do it.
Even when he interrupts over and over, wrong, wrong, wrong.
Yeah, you know, because I think a lot of them wish that they could be doing the same exact thing. You know, they wish they could have been saying those things for 20 or 30 years, and now finally somebody has come along and done it. You know, I don't think that it's an especially healthy reaction. I've tried to talk both in my public platform, but also just one-on-one with family and try to convince them that this guy is not necessarily the solution to our problems. But he, again, he's trying, and I think it's such a powerful feeling to be seen when you felt for so long like nobody has even looked in your direction.
I'm just struck, JD, that Trump seems to have read you. I mean, this 30-year phrase, Hillary, you've been there for 30 years. Something has dropped out since, what, mid-Reagan. Where is the Iraq war in the undercurrent of our unhappiness?
I think it's a really big part of it. You know, we tend to talk about these things as economic anxieties. And my sense is that the economic stuff is sort of secondary to a lot of the other things that are going on, a lot of these other issues. You know, I talked about the opioid addiction. I talk about family breakdown. But the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, this sense of constant military conflict is definitely a part of this frustration, too. So you think about the makeup of the modern military. You think of especially the combat deaths of the modern military. And what you find is that they are heavily working in middle class, so it's not especially wealthy people. It's not necessarily those who are impoverished. It's folks who are voting primarily Republican, and it's people in the Rust Belt in Appalachia in the South. And so you think about that, that's almost the description of Donald Trump's base, right? But you think about these folks who are sending their children to fight in these wars, have sent their children on 4, 5, 6 deployments over the course of their military career. And they're really mad and they're very upset about what has happened. And that anger exists along a couple of axes, right? So one of them is that they feel like their kids did their job. They went over there, they trained well, they fought well, they did everything they could, they were courageous, and yet they don't have any victory to show for it. They've watched their kids lose their lives, lose their minds, lose body parts for wars that are fundamentally humiliating to the people who fought them. You know, I was in the Marine Corps, and one of the great regrets of my life is that I spent 7 months in Iraq. I've watched good friends come back with burns all over their body. And I wonder, what did we accomplish over there? What do I tell my kids that we did that we're really proud of? And you think about the World War II generation, and they were able to say they liberated Europe. You know, what are we going to be able to say about the Middle East 15, 20 years from now? My worry is that we're not going to be able to say anything that's good. And that is a really, really powerful factor that makes people, again, angry, frustrated, and upset at the people who made the decisions about who to send their kids and when to send their kids to war. So that's one big part of it. The other part of it is that you have people coming home, and like I said, they're injured in mind or body, and they end up fighting with this veteran affairs bureaucracy that is so hard. It's so hard to get care on time. It's so hard to get access to a hospital when you should. You hear about people who, you know, they're literally standing in the halls of the VA screaming for care, and nobody does anything for them. And they wait 6 weeks to get a basic doctor's appointment. And so what does that do? It makes them feel like, you know, my kids, my neighborhood's children, my niece, my nephew, they went off, they did their job, and they've come home. And because of government bureaucrats, they're not getting the things that were owed. They're not getting the things that people said would come to them. And at the end of the day, they're not coming to them at all. And so those two factors really add to this sense that the people who are in control, the people who are making decisions about what to do with our blood and our treasure, don't know what they're doing, and we're upset about it.
Mm. Add the awful number. I think it's true that there have been more suicides among Iraq soldiers than there were combat deaths.
Yeah, it's the number has got to be pretty close. I know that it's in the thousands, the number of soldiers who have killed themselves over the past 10, 15 years. And again, it's not strangers to these people. These aren't things that they read about on the news. They certainly do that, but they also see it in their own communities, see it in their own neighborhoods. They know these people. These are their friends, their neighbors, their family members. And that really adds, you know, a really intense emotional element to this feeling, again, of a downward trajectory, of a world that isn't moving in the right direction.
But can they vote on that anger, or can they vote on that sadness? It doesn't surface much in the campaign that, you know, who was responsible for that war.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't. But I will say that this is something that the Trump campaign, both vis-a-vis Republican elites and Democratic elites, has sort of tortured these people with, right? He's really gone after both the Bush, former Bush administration officials, and over the Clintons over their various roles in supporting or prosecuting the Iraq War. And this has been, I think, a really underappreciated part of his appeal, is that you take these folks who are frustrated, like I said, for a couple of different reasons about the conduct of our military affairs, and this guy is really the first to go after both parties in a really aggressive, really emotional way. Again, I think that resonates.
JD, you're not a big believer in sort of government solutions necessarily, but what would the next president do to repay Middletown for their votes? If the next president listened hard, read your book three times, what could he or she do about it?
Well, there are interventions that you can make that are positive in the lives of poor kids, but they typically happen much earlier than when the government is currently operating. So, you know, we talk about Pell Grants, but those come in when a kid is 18 or 19 years old. What kids need is better support when they're 4 or 5 years old. So what I'd like to see our government do, what I'd like to see, you know, not just our federal government, but state and local respond to, is one, a recognition that home life and family life really matters. There are a lot of things that we can do to enhance and encourage better home lives among poor children. We're not doing hardly any of them right now, but we could be doing a lot more. And that is, at the end of the day, one reason that I wrote the book. I hope that it would give a really thick description of what a lot of these problems look like, because I listen to Trump and I listen to Hillary Clinton, and I think maybe they both mean well, but none of them are really talking about interventions when they could really help. None of them are really talking about addressing some of these problems at a point in kids' lives when maybe there's something to be gained from it. So I worry that effectively Donald Trump's approach to anti-poverty is let's redo the 1980s, and Hillary Clinton's approach to anti-poverty is let's redo the 1960s. And at the end of the day, I don't think those solutions are good enough. I think we have to think a lot more innovatively about how to address these problems.
Thank you, J.D. Vance. Thank you also, Arlie Hochschild and Bonnie Jo Campbell. There are photographs and lots more online at radioopensource.org. Check it all out. And while you're up, join the conversation in the comments, please. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Frank Horton, Zach Goldhammer, and Becca DiGregorio. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Leidman. Join us next time on Open Source.